Welcome to this episode of Menopause Uprising with me, your host, Catherine O'Keefe. Today is an episode I have been really excited to share with you, and I know you will get so much from my conversation today. I'm thrilled to chat today with Kathleen King, and Kathleen is a well-known advocate for endometriosis, having lived with the condition herself, and she shares with us today her own experience, where we're at in Ireland and what needs to happen, and most importantly, the signs that you need to be aware of in relation to endometriosis. I hope you enjoy the episode, and as always, please do rate, review and comment on the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on. So Kathleen, thanks so much for chatting with me. And endometriosis, I'm actually really thrilled to see that I feel, and I could be wrong, you're in the right position to tell me, but I do feel I'm now finally hearing it being discussed more. And I would say I've kind of felt that in the last 12 months compared to maybe 10 years ago, we weren't having as much awareness around endometriosis. Is that fair to say?
It is. And Catherine, thanks very much for having me on. Endometriosis awareness has really started to come to the fore. And I think in the last 12 to 24 months, we've seen a lot of people come forward with their own social media accounts and their own experiences. And we're starting to see that being picked up in the mainstream media. And then we've also had the documentary Below the Belt, which helped to sort of bring that not just to, you know, the endometriosis audience, but also to a wider audience as well too. So we're starting to see that, you know, that ability to be able to talk about it and that willingness to be able to talk about it. And that's a fantastic change. You know, we've had the Endo March there recently, and I always tell the story, the first Endo March that I tried to organize back in 2013. So I sent out a poll to people, and I was like, well, we should do an Endo March as part of the international event. Where will we do it? Would you like to take part? And the first question was like, you know, should we have a public event? And over 90% came back and said no. They didn't want to be seen in public.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
We had so many people saying, look, I can't follow the social media pages, or I don't share articles because maybe my family doesn't know how much I suffer. It's quite embarrassing. Maybe my work colleagues don't know that I've got fertility issues, you know, and people felt that it was so private and so shameful and so deeply personal. But fast forward now 10 years, and we have people making their own Instagram accounts, their own video reels, they're on TikTok, they're chatting about it. They're, you know, if you look for somebody for a media article now, it's so much easier. So there's definitely been a shift. But then the counter side to that is you do have a lot more misinformation now coming out, because not everybody's taking the time to research the facts alongside their own personal story, unfortunately.
And misinformation, I mean, yeah, like misinformation is so dangerous, isn't it? Because I see that on social media in relation to perimenopause, menopause, and I see it from the point of view of I see misinformation. But what I also kind of see, which I think is very dangerous, is people who are not medical, people giving advice. And that's also very dangerous, because, you know, I think it's very, very important for any condition or any, you know, chapter, depending on the severity, like with menopause, I think it's really important that you've got the right medical advice and doctor working with you. When we look at endometriosis, Kathleen, would you mind just explaining, you know, for people who aren't familiar with it, what exactly endometriosis is?
Yeah, endometriosis is a chronic inflammatory disease that tends to be quite progressive over time, predominantly affects women. So we estimate that 1 in 9 women live with symptoms of endometriosis. And it's sort of characterized predominantly by pain. Most women will have pain, be it pelvic pain, back pain. You know, some women will experience infertility as well. It's one of the leading causes of infertility. But it's, again, important to know that not everybody with endometriosis will experience infertility. But the condition then sort of is defined by where you've got particular types of cells that sort of take up in different parts of the body. And it's thought that we're believed to be born with these cells in place. And then an event such as puberty or a hormonal shift activates these cells, and they're fueled by estrogen and progesterone to a little bit. They can also create their own estrogen as well too, which is very interesting. But that stimulus then has led it to be linked really to menstruation and those that peaks around ovulation and around menstruation as well. So we now know with, I suppose, research over time and people talking about it, that it's not just tied to menstruation. It can be a whole body disease. So, you know, the lesions can be found anywhere in the body. You know, you could have them in the lungs or on the diaphragm, in the pelvis, so around the bowel, the bladder, the ovaries. But you can also have the systemic effects. So the brain fog, you might have the joint pains, that overall feelings of fatigue. You get your sort of, you know, classic links then to things like bowel symptoms, you've migraine, you know, you've got a lot of things sort of going on there together as well. And some people, like, they're in pain 24/7. Like, it's quite a difficult condition to live with.
It really is, isn't it? And I kind of, you know, I always kind of say, you know, like, endometriosis, the pain of it, it's not, some people kind of think it's maybe severe period pain, but as you just said, it's so much more than that, isn't it? And, you know, the fact that you can, you know, it can be the lungs, it can be so many other parts of the body. In terms of getting diagnosed, what's that like now? Because I know it was taken, like, what is it, 10 years or something. Is it still the same, or how is that?
It is. I'd love to tell you that's got better in the last 25 years, but it hasn't. You know, certainly when I started this journey, the average time was 7 to 12 years worldwide. And we're still in that 7 to 12 year average as well. Ireland is about 9 years. And unfortunately, younger women presenting under the age of 25 with symptoms will have a longer delay to diagnosis, because we just don't believe younger women when they present with pain.
Shocking, often women, isn't it?
Oh, it's crazy.
It's really,
it is
shocking.
Absolutely crazy. And we've seen younger women now, you know, realizing that if they go in with fertility concerns, you know, they may be taken a little bit more seriously and maybe referred a little bit earlier, but it's very, very difficult. And often women are put on the pill maybe for, you know, a couple of decades, and it's only when they come back in their late 30s, maybe early 40s, you know, and are investigated for fertility issues that they might discover then that they have endometriosis. So there's so many factors that lead into it. Like, education is one thing on the behalf of the women, but also education on behalf for healthcare professionals. The attitude is still, unfortunately, out there with a lot of healthcare professionals that this is your lot and you need to suffer it. And that is just like a, very much like a bad period. But, you know, the thing that we always say to people to differentiate between the symptoms is that if you're missing something like a family wedding, or you're missing something like your exams, or you're missing something like, you know, a huge amount of time at college or at work, you know, that's a red flag. Painful sex is another one that we don't talk about enough, and it's a red flag, and it's usually very, you know, tightly associated with endometriosis. Maybe the bowel or bladder symptoms, pain when opening the bowels, pain after emptying the bladder. They're all things that can, you know, help differentiate that out from maybe other causes as well. So it's a tricky one.
And do you think, in terms of, you know, let's say you are maybe your late teens, your early 20s, and you're going to your doctor and you're like that, maybe you're missing family events or you're missing exams because of the severity of the pain. Do you think, is it the education piece now that needs to change first, so that doctors actually listen to that, you know, 20-year-old who's saying, listen, there is something wrong here? Is that down to education, or, you know, where else do you go?
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I think we've got a multi sort of faced approach to this one. We need to look at, you know, empowering women with the information to recognize that something's wrong. Because if your mum and your aunt and your grandmum also had very, very painful symptoms, you may not recognize that this is abnormal, first of all. And this is where we have a schools project called MISHA, which is in pilot at the moment. And that's where we're going to educate teens about endometriosis and to look out for symptoms that might be abnormal. The other side that then as well is when you go into your GP, you have a very short appointment, and they are being bombarded with symptoms that may be quite vague. It may be that you only have very severe fatigue, or you may have back pain that radiates down your leg. There's a lot of things that cause that. The bowel upsets are usually put down to IBS or put down to poor diet. So often it can be very different, you know, difficult to differentiate that out. And this is why we try and get the red flags across, start to ask the questions in that short space of time. But the lack of objective evidence at primary care is very difficult. And I'm involved in a research project at the moment that is trying to develop a wearable device that will help collect data from the body, use an AI as well, combined with the person's symptoms to help diagnose that, you know, within a period of 3 months, as opposed to somebody having to go back to 9 doctors over 9 years. So that would be a game changer. And then you have the bottleneck then with the HSE, and, you know, where you get referred to the gynecologists and the waiting list could be 4 years. So you've got so many roadblocks along the way.
And then, of course, the big thing is the biggest roadblock is if you feel you're not being listened to. If you feel that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, even in your own head, it must be like, is this in my head? You know, why am I, you know, why is this happening to me? And then particularly if you're not, if you don't have anyone who's kind of saying, well, you know, listen, there's a high chance it's endometriosis or X, Y, or Z. And Kathleen, am I right in saying a blood test isn't of any benefit to you at all?
No, we've got no non-invasive tests at the moment. So no blood tests. Some ultrasound or MRI in very specialist areas and very specialist hands as well can identify endometriosis, but only in its very large form. So when it's only when it's there as cysts or very large nodules, which is only about 20% of endometriosis patients. Okay. For those with peritoneal, very superficial disease, that's not going to be detectable. And we don't have enough of those skilled people in this country to do that. So you're really talking about surgery for diagnosis. So you're going in for keyhole surgery to look into the pelvis, identify the disease, and then remove it if possible. So you can see now where the delays come in. You've got your general anaesthetic. It's a day case. There's only so much they can do in a day. And we all know that women's health and gynecology is the first thing to be cancelled once we have either a winter surge, EDs are full, you know, the hospital's busy, and unfortunately women's health gets pushed so far down the list, you know. And I think, you know, the one thing I've seen over the last 25 years that hasn't changed is that as women, we're not treated as reliable witnesses to our own suffering. If I say I'm in pain, I really do have to justify that. Whereas I know if a male counterpart of the same age goes in and presents in pain, they're going to be given pain relief straight away. And like you find that with women, we have to fight to justify our symptoms and to find, you know, to get somebody to believe us, I think is always very difficult. And I'm not seeing a quick enough change in that, unfortunately.
And look, sure, I see that. I mean, I see that with perimenopause all the way through. And now, we've had great shifts in terms of education awareness, but I still get the messages every week from someone saying, you know, oh, I've been just told to get on with it, or, you know, this is just part of life. And you're just kind of, you just feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall, you know, because like no one should be suffering. Nobody should be suffering. There's no, in this day and age, there's absolutely, there's no need for it. And I think, you know, that certainly is something that we still have a lot of work to do. And I think, look, there's a lot needs to be done around women's health. Like, just as you said, it is the first thing that's pushed down when the winter vomiting bug or whatever happens, you know, it's further down the ladder, you know, which is, that's not right either, you know. Do a lot of Irish people end up going abroad to get diagnosis?
They do. Unfortunately, I mean, we have a lot of people traveling. We have a number of individuals throughout the world who have dedicated their entire practice to endometriosis. Now, there's not very many of them. I think the last count somebody estimated there was about maybe 200 to 300, but that's for 200 million people living with endometriosis worldwide. It's not accessible. In Ireland at the moment, we used to have a lot of people travel to the UK because you're able to use your insurance on the cross-border directive, which was very good to help bring back money, you know, to help with the costs. But unfortunately, with Brexit, that went. So there's a particular doctor in Romania that people travel to. There are some doctors in Austria and Germany, the Czech Republic, and Greece. And, you know, we've had patients who have traveled to Dubai and also to the US as well for surgery. So, you know, like, people are investing a huge amount of money. They're remortgaging the house, they're taking money out of savings, they're taking big loans. Now, the only thing is, with expert surgery and with somebody who has dedicated their life skills to doing this and is using excision, you have the chance of really improving your quality of life. We have no cure for endometriosis. All you can do is remove the disease as best you can. And then you start adding in all your little bits. And it's a bit like menopause and perimenopause, where you need to take in all the factors. So you've got your lifestyle, you've got all that's going to help with that as well. For us, it's pelvic physio. You know, the dietary side, nutrition side is very important. Pain management maybe as well, if you're left with residual pain. So there's lots of things that feed into it, but it's usually the first step is usually starts with excision surgery.
Yeah, and it's like so difficult having to go abroad. I mean, look, I see that a lot, you know, obviously with endometriosis and also fertility, like it's a shame. Like there's a lot we can do. There's a lot we should be doing here so that you don't have the added stress of having to go somewhere else, you know. And Kathleen, would you mind just sharing a little bit about your own story, your own experience?
Yeah, for me, I suppose now I'm living with symptoms for 35 years. So when I had my first period, I ended up in horrendous pain and a very serious amount of bleeding. I was very, very quickly became iron deficient. And at the age of 12, even though I was quite medically minded at the time, because I knew I wanted to work in medicine, I knew that was where I was going. And I had read so much about menstruation. I'd read, you know, home medical textbooks and things like that. And I was going, this just doesn't seem right. So by 14, I'd actually self-diagnosed and I had found the word endometriosis. I was delighted with myself because, I was the business.
Ahead
I
of
was
the
over
game.
To the GP. Exactly. And the GP more or less went, get out, you know, you're not over 30. Get out. And then that was grand. So I spent 2 years fighting with her to get pain meds. And after 2 years, then I was nearly 16 and she was like, you're just looking for the pill. And I was like, if the pill's going to help with the bleeding and the pain, I'll take it. But I'm not looking for it in the way that you're implying. Yeah. So she made me get a letter signed by my parents. And I got that. And I went through, I think, every shape and form and brand of the pill and got nowhere. Seen multiple doctors then through college. And it was only when I started to do my training in the hospital, you know, as part of my degree, that I actually had money and I was able to pay privately to go to Northern Ireland, where the consultant, now I went in with a book about this thick, to go in and say, look, here's my symptoms. I'm sure I have this. And I was ready for the fight. And he just flicked through 2 pages. And he went, oh, no, you definitely have it. We'll do the surgery. No fighting at all with him. And
so that
done the
must have
surgery.
Been. That, sorry, Kathleen, that must have been kind of a liberation, that, you know, just someone who's
huge.
Finally
Yep.
listening to you.
Huge. And I was pure lucky because the person, one of the people I had met when I moved up here was a nurse and she had great experience with this particular gynecologist. And she said, look, if he can't help you, nobody can, you know, and to be believed at that first appointment it was unbelievable because I'd spent the previous 9 years fighting with so many people and being told I was overdramatic, I had a low pain threshold, I was catastrophizing, I wanted to get out of school, I wanted to get out of college, I wanted to avoid things in life. So it was, yeah, it was a huge relief. And then to have the confirmation that surgery was massive, you know, it was great. But unfortunately, I've had 8 surgeries, the majority of which were outside of Ireland. My last surgery was excision, and that was 6 years ago, and my life totally changed with that and totally changed for the better. The previous surgeries were a combination of ablation because that was what was done at the time. And the two previous to the one I've you know, my last one were presumed to be excision, but when my surgeon, the expert surgeon, went in for the last surgery, he found endometriosis that had never been removed. And that has led to long-term nerve damage, unfortunately. So I do live with chronic pain, but I've had a 95% pain reduction, which has been amazing. It has been absolutely life-changing, but it was a long battle to get there. You know, and I think along the way, you sort of realize that we've very little treatment options for women. Like, even you're forced into choosing between your quality of life and fertility, because most of the drugs that you're taking to suppress your cycle, you can't get pregnant on. Or if you're taking very heavy pain medications, it's not going to work with somebody who's gone down the fertility road. And I've really seen that, because once I was diagnosed, I started into advocacy and volunteering and helping. And I realized that apart from the education level, you know, and not just of clinicians, but in women themselves, along with the treatment options that we had, it was so, so limited that something had to be done, you know, and slowly we're starting to see change, but again, very slowly.
Gosh, that's some amount of surgeries, isn't it? Like eight surgeries. And did you say all of them were out of Ireland?
The majority of them were, I had two within the Republic of Ireland. The majority then were UK. And my last one was in Atlanta in the US.
US, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
So and that journey was, over.
That has been your most successful one.
It has. He removed all of the endometriosis from my bowel, my bladder, all the pelvic sidewalls. I also had my fallopian tubes, my uterus taken out as well, because I had adenomyosis as well. And I lost my appendix. And what else was in there as well too? There was just all the endometriosis that he was able to find, he took out.
Gosh.
Yeah, it was crazy. And like every surgery prior to that, I'd been told that I had very minimal endometriosis and that there was nothing really left there, you know. So to go in and find so much of it and then to have that amazing relief afterwards was proof, I think, as well, too, that, you know, you do have to trust your own body. You have to trust yourself, basically.
Yeah.
And even 100%. Me, knowing what I know, had started to lose that, you know. So.
And did you find, like, after the surgery, was it kind of, you know, a few days afterwards or was it weeks afterwards where you started to feel better?
It was literally hours. When I went into my surgery, yeah, I was taking two high strength opioids. So I was taking the equivalent of 385 morphine equivalents every day.
Oh, Kathleen, my gosh.
It was crazy. I don't know how I was functioning.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
Like, how did you keep life going?
I know. I think through time, you probably get used to it and you find ways around it, you know. But when I think back on it now, like I couldn't have been functioning. I couldn't have been safe, like, you know, and thankfully my partner done all the driving and done all the bits and pieces like that, probably knowing that I wasn't going to be the best. But no, within hours of the surgery, they come in and they woke me up at about 3 a.m. They said, look, we need to get you up for a walk. And I was like, oh, yeah, no problem. I'll get up. And I was expecting to feel bad and feel pain. But they got me up and I walked down the corridor and I was like, what's going on? I feel like I've done like 1,000 sit-ups, but I don't feel like I've had surgery, you know? And then I was like, oh, hang on, my pain's gone. My pain that's been there since I was 12 is gone.
Oh my gosh.
And the nurses were laughing. They just thought this was amazing. They were like, oh, it's the pain meds. And I was like, no, the pain's gone. So after, like, you know, even having the uterus removed and having the big, big, massive surgery, the following day I was out walking around, you know, I was able to do small walks around the hotel. And, you know, those walks got bigger day by day. And so much so that I actually had to set alarms to remember to take my pain meds, because I had gone from such a high level of pain down to surgical pain, which is a totally different and manageable pain altogether.
Wow.
Crazy.
And do you still have some residual pain from, you know, particularly the number of surgeries and, you know, internally and everything?
Yeah, I have some nerve damage from a combination of the previous surgeries and just that the endometriosis was left sitting on a nerve for so long. So that nerve damage then does cause pain. Now it flares up, you know, quite badly every now and again, but it's totally manageable. I do take a very low dose of opioids every day as part of my management with my pain team. And that at the minute gets me through. So for my surgery, the surgeon felt he could offer me about a 70% improvement in pain quality.
Yeah.
And like I've 95% reduction in the pain meds. So that to me
that's a great result.
I'll take it. Oh, it's brilliant.
That's
like,
a great result, so, isn't it? But I mean, gosh, after it's such a long journey. And I think that's what I feel is that the you know, the really challenging part of endometriosis is how long it takes to be diagnosed and how long you're kind of, you're in a way, you're alone on that journey, you know, with just you knowing there's something not right here, but who's going to listen to me? And, you know, how am I going to get myself diagnosed? You know, and I think that's obviously where we need to see a lot of change happen, right, in Ireland and globally. Is there any plans, you know, in Ireland at the moment, you know, happening at a national level in terms of endometriosis care?
Yeah, the government had announced an endometriosis framework over 12 months ago now, where they were going to try and upskill surgeons within regional hubs, and then having 2 to 3 sort of, you know, super centres at which endometriosis is treated. Now, unfortunately, that model looks like it's based on what they use in the UK, which has a very low bar in terms of number of complex surgeries that's carried out every year. So while there's an endometriosis specialist clinic in place in name and the surgeons are doing their very, very best, they're still quite restricted because they practice other areas of gynecology as well. And in some cases, they're still obstetric practitioners. So you could be delivering a baby in one theatre and then straight in to do endometriosis in another. And okay, having spoken to, you know, expert endometriosis surgeons worldwide, the consensus is you need to give your entire life to endometriosis because it is so complex, and you need to, this is one disease where you need to know your enemy, because very few diseases in the body can affect all tissues, all organs. You need to be able to recognize all of its forms. It can appear quite different within different patients, and to be able to manage that safely. So you have to go from taking maybe something off the outside of the bladder to, you know, maybe going up to somebody's diaphragm to go back to the bowel. You know, you need that confidence, and that does require a high level of surgery. So most expert surgeons worldwide would do, you know, the 300 to 400 a year. And unfortunately, what we're seeing coming out from sort of patient reports here is that some of the surgeons are only meeting about 30 or 40 cases a year of very complex endometriosis. Now, I'm hoping that's going to change, but it's going to take a lot of time. I think it's going to take a lot of investment from the government as well to try and upskill surgeons to allow them to get to that level of training, because it is quite a complex disease.
And it is, like you say, it's having someone who, listen, this is my gig, this is what I'm focused on. You're not trying to span, you know, different, you're not, like as you say, you're not going from the labor ward into something else, you know, into endometriosis surgery. And I think that's really important, because then it's just niching, isn't it, instead of trying to be not a jack of all trades, but you know what I mean, it just kind of narrow it down. And I think anything, if you look at any aspect of women's health, I mean, I think that's key, isn't it?
It is.
You know, having the specialists that are there who have that knowledge. Is it, I know you mentioned Romania earlier. Is it the US and Romania that tend to be ahead in relation to this globally, Kathleen?
Unfortunately, there's no country has got its act together and has a perfect setup for endometriosis. Do see with the European countries, some of the German speaking countries, they have an accreditation system, and it's slightly different than the UK, and that standard's quite good. It's not perfect, but it still involves patients as part of the accreditation. I think that's quite good. But what we're finding is that people are traveling to individual surgeons or individual clinics, as opposed to the area where it is. So, you know, there may be only one or two surgeons in Romania that are excellent, whereas the rest of it will be pretty much like Ireland. It'll be a routine gynecologist. So, and we found in the UK that where surgeons were working within the NHS and maybe seeing occasionally private patients, they've had to go completely private to be able to take on the full caseload of endometriosis on its own, because very similar constraints to here. So it's very, very difficult. There's not one country has a good plan at the moment. And there is the ESHRE European guidelines for European countries. And then we have the NICE guidelines in the UK. So Ireland tends to follow a bit of both. But again, they don't come down hard and strong enough on that number of cases. And I think most patients, and certainly patients with very complex disease, you know, deserve to have that level of treatment. We've specialized oncology right down to levels. And if we look at breast cancer, it's a great example. You know, that's totally changed the way it's been treated and how it's been managed. And, you know, endometriosis, you know, does require that level of input, multidisciplinary input, and that specialist input as well. So, but unfortunately at the minute, it is individual doctors that are driving this forward in their own area.
It's really tough, isn't it? Is it defined as like within, if you're diagnosed with endometriosis, do you automatically get a medical card here?
No.
Okay, so
there's no.
So
no.
It's similar. Yeah, it's similar to premature ovarian insufficiency, yeah. Which is a huge bugbear of mine. That, you know, the young girls, you know, automatically, I feel they straight away, you should automatically get a medical card, exactly the same for endometriosis, because the cost of medication that you're buying on a monthly basis is so challenging, isn't it? And then that's a financial burden. And, you know, on top of that, you've got this huge physical and psychological burden as well.
And that's the thing. And you've got a huge loss of productivity as well, too. Like if you're not able to attend school or college, it's going to affect your career choices. You might not get to work in the area that you want to work in. It's then you're in the workplace. Your productivity could be very low. You may miss quite a lot of days. That affects your income as well, too. We've got women, unfortunately, who've had to give up their jobs because their pain is so severe and their sick leave is so high. That they're taken out of the workplace. But it's not recognized as a disability. What we find, some women have been able to make cases for, you know, like GP only cards, or have been able to make cases for, you know, like disability benefits based on individual symptoms and the impact it has on them. But the label of endometriosis itself, the feedback we've had through patients over the years is it's like, that's bad periods. Everybody gets those.
Oh,
and
God.
That's the attitude you get back.
horrific.
When you fill out a form.
Horrific, yeah. Isn't it? Because it should be like, it is a chronic condition. And it's again, like POI, like who wants to have endometriosis? Who wants to have BOI? Nobody does, you know? And it's like, yeah, I think that's one major shift that we need to make in Ireland. And to me, it's just, that is just a no brainer. That needs to happen, you know. If you look back, Kathleen, and I know just when you're talking about your own experience, but even from the women you have worked with and talked to, I mean, how do you handle the psychological part of it?
That is difficult. That is really difficult. For me, I suppose I channeled all that anger into advocacy work. And trying to make sure that nobody else coming behind me was going to face the same difficulties and the challenges and not being believed and all of that. So like I volunteered in the UK helpline for a long number of years. I ran the Irish Association for you know, a good number of years as well too. And when you're dealing with women on an individual basis and that level of suffering, it is the impact that it has on them is something else. It really, really is. And that aside too, that people don't understand, I think, the impact of a chronic illness. You know, it is debilitating and it really does mess with your head, because you're seen as the person who's flaky. You're always cancelling appointments. You might not be able to turn up to something, you know, or you turn up to something and you're really unwell and you have to go home. It trashes your mental health at times. And that combined with, you know, chronic pain, once it gets into your head, you know, you can find that you're in this cycle of exacerbation of pain along then with the psychological side. It's huge. And this is why endometriosis needs that multidisciplinary support. Like it needs, you know, you need your mental health services, you need your physical services, you need your surgery, you need all of those things working together.
Yeah, it's so important, isn't it? Because, you know, I think to be left, even, you know, that before you get a diagnosis, you know, the challenges that are there. I mean, I think they're harrowing. They're harrowing until you get that kind of confirmation as to what's happening. But then that's only the start of the journey, isn't it? Because once you get that, then it's, well, okay, you know, what's to happen from here? And that's emotionally, that's massive, be it from fertility perspective, just life perspective and long-term management, etc. It's massive. I think It's one thing I just on my newsletter this week, I was talking a lot about anxiety in menopause, and it's an aspect of menopause that, oh gosh, I could say every day I'll get emails or DMs about how, you know, women are feeling, the psychological part of it. And I think sometimes I just wonder, sometimes do we just try and keep the brave face on it, and we try and, okay, we can keep it all together because that's what women do. But I actually think, you know, we just need to cut ourselves some more slack and just get the supports that we need to kind of, you know, and like, you know, as you, like how many years you had to go through before you got that kind of, you had your final surgery and things really changed. It's like having the support there is just so important, isn't it?
Oh, it's essential. And you find, you know, within certainly any chronic community or any health community like that, you will find that the community becomes that support for you. You know, I have made the most amazing friends over the last 20 odd years, you know, people who I've never met, but I speak to every day of the week, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
And then people I've been very fortunate to meet because they live in the same country, but people who do change your life just by being there at 3 a.m. when it's got really bad and it's got very dark. But you're right, we do tend to pick up and push on. And that's something I'm really, really guilty of doing. I don't pace myself. I burn through things. I do everything I tell people not to do. And I need to cut myself on. I'm awful at it. I don't pace. I don't rest. You know, I don't look after myself. I'll burn. And the thing is, then when you do crash, it's hard to come back from that, you know. But you do need to look at it as in, it's not a weakness. This is no different than any other chronic condition like diabetes or asthma or anything like that. We just need to change our mindset around that, and myself included, because even at times I still feel that I have to prove myself, you know, even though like I might have a pain flare, but I'll still go and do something instead of resting, because it's like, I don't want people not to believe that I'm in pain, you know. And that's funny, like 35 years later, that's still in my head.
Yeah, that
somebody
that is,
might
isn't
not
it?
Believe me.
Yeah,
it's strange, gosh. Isn't it? It stays that, with you, like.
That's a real, you know, like, isn't that, you know, the body remembers, and there's that, like, you know, and the body remembers what it was like for you at 12, and it remembers the reactions that you got to that. And I think, you know, that is something that it's like you kind of have to be aware, I think, of anything like that at all. That's the starting point, isn't it? And once you have the awareness, then you can kind of start to kind of, okay, you know, maybe move from it. But I do think, you know, like that's something we're all can be at fault of, you know. I'll go, you know, I'll perk myself up or whatever. But I will say, I find now for me, and some of it's age for sure, and some of it's definitely menopause, but I'll totally go with where I'm at, you know. If I'm just like, okay, not happening today, and I'm like, kind of, okay, it's just not happening today. And, you know, I'll give you a good example for that would be, you know, there's sometimes, if you're doing things on social media, you know, it's like, okay, you got to be in the frame for that. So if I'm not, okay, it's not going to happen today. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I certainly now would listen to my body a lot more. And like, I will know, like, say you wake up, Kathleen, we all have it, you know, you wake up in the morning, you're just like, ugh. You know, that's the morning I know I got to go for a run, or I got to go up the mountains. I've just got to make sure I carve out that extra hour for myself to just get out. No, and with me, I don't care what the weather is like. I'll get out in it. And that's the game changer, I find. And I think it's for everyone, it's finding your game changer, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's so important to even look for that, like, you know. And I think for me, in the last few years, I've discovered, you know, that I can grow vegetables and self-sustain here. And that has been amazing. I have to say, it has been a lifesaver, where there's been days I've come in from work really stressed, or things have piled up and I'm just like, I'm going to the poly tunnel. Don't come looking for me. The phone's not coming, you know? And like that has been good. So maybe I am learning. Do you know what? That's probably perimenopause kicking in now and making me a bit more sensible at this stage.
I'd say you are learning. And I do, that's where I always kind of say, that's where we have those little snippets of opportunities that do come with menopause. And I will argue, yes, there's an aging, the wisdom, all of that. It all kind of collides together. Yeah. But you definitely, you just become more settled or that bit firmer in knowing this is good for me now, or this isn't, or you know, X, Y, or Z. And I find great solace in that now. I can look back at, you know, different situations, different relationships, friendships, etc., and you kind of your view is different, or my view is different in terms of maybe you just, I guess you're looking at what you want to attract into your life and what is supporting you in your life at different stages. And I think there's a calmness that comes maybe with age, but like bringing perimenopause into it as well. But I do think that comes, and it's a settling, you know, doesn't happen overnight.
No, it is. And there's some days you think I have this sauced, and then other days you're like, no, the anxiety just kicks in. You're like,
totally. That niggling anxiety. And I, you know, like as I said, I think it's one I tune into that a lot now, because probably one of my earlier symptoms of perimenopause was anxiety. I'd never had it before, so it was like, what's going on here? And got through that. But I would be very conscious now of when I start to see anything rear its head, I'm curious. I go into it and I try and understand what's happening. And that's what works for me, you know, but it's be different for all of us, you know. We sidetracked there. Sorry, that was me. I don't know what polytunnel I went down there.
Are you aware of that one anyway?
Yeah. If you were to give someone advice who thinks maybe they have endometriosis, or what those key red flags are, what they can do, what is that?
I think the first thing is, you know, have confidence in your symptoms and have confidence in yourself. So believe what's happening to yourself and start writing it down. There's loads of menstrual apps. There's loads of symptom tracking apps. There's the good old pen and paper, which some people like. And it's quite nice because you can sort of flick through things and see what's going on. But anything that's going to show you a pattern is really important. Because the first thing a clinician is going to look for is that pattern. Is this happening every day? Is it every week? Is it with your cycle? Those things are important. Start looking at some of the symptoms of endometriosis online. So that could be, you know, pain after emptying your bladder. It could be shoulder tip pain. It could be pain when emptying the bowels, or blood when you empty the bowels as well. It could be pelvic pain, lower back pain, pain that travels down the leg, heavy bleeding, heavy menstrual bleeding. And that sort of chronic fatigue. Migraines are linked as well too. And what we do see in, I would say, almost every woman I've met with endometriosis has a thing called endobelly, so much so that I can nearly diagnose people with it. And it's a type of bloating where you literally can go, you could be standing here chatting to me now and my belly will just swell out of nowhere. And that inflammation, and we don't really know what causes it other than that it's an inflammatory thing. And normally when somebody's pain is very high or they're about to go into a flare, you see this endobelly, and it's led to that horrible thing where people come up and, you know, congratulate you for being pregnant when you're just having a bad flare day.
Oh gosh.
Yeah, that is, and like, believe it, like for me, who's not even gone down the fertility road, that has come up so often, and it ends up being funny. But I think it's recognizing the symptoms, getting them written down, you know, go to trusted sources of information as well too. Like, so, you know, we've got endowatt.com, we've endometriosis.org as well, are two very good sites for information. And, you know, have a look at that, speak to other people, you know, but make that appointment with the GP and go through you know, the things, ask for a referral. And if there's a family history of endometriosis, that's so important because, you know, if you have a first degree relative who has endometriosis or suspected endometriosis, you're 7 times more likely to be diagnosed.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
and I know when I chat to women, especially in their 30s, they're sort of looking at me going, oh, but I've always had bad periods, or they've never been that bad. But when you drill down into it, you find that, you know, 70% of teens who've had severe pelvic pain, you know, during that teenage years, like, you know, especially associated with menstruation, go on to be diagnosed with endometriosis. So we've gone from a disease where I was told you need to be over 30. You know, we now know, like, we're born with the disease, it's there in place, something kicks it off. And like, I have young women who are now traveling for surgery, you know, and they're 14, 16, 18 years of age. I've also had a woman recently enough who's only just been diagnosed in her 50s. So it's never too, you're never too young, never too old.
Yeah.
But I think the main thing is you really do need to trust yourself, advocate for yourself. And if you're not being listened to, and I know in this day and age it's very difficult because GPs are getting very rare, you might need to change your GP, you know, or somebody else within the practice even to be listened to. But it's just, it's getting that first sort of step as well too. And I hope, you know, Catherine, we have this conversation in maybe 5 years' time, that we will have a device available, we'll have a home diagnosis or an in-surgery diagnosis where we won't have to go through a laparoscopy to show that this disease is here. We're not there yet, but eventually we will.
Would be fabulous. It would be such a life changer for so many people, wouldn't it?
Really would. It really would.
Kathleen, thanks so much for chatting. It was a pleasure as always. And thanks everyone for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I will share some of the resources that Kathleen mentioned so that you can check them out in the show notes. And as I said, don't forget to rate, review or comment on the podcast on whichever channel you've watched it on. Thank you.